This is the wreck of all their plans, then. It is the end. I, too, have thrown my life into ruin with a dream. And then Igraine was ashamed of herself that she could think of her own misery when Vivian was to lie down in childbed, from which it could hardly be hoped that she would ever rise again. In horror, weeping in dread, she couldn't even turn from the mirror. And then Vivian raised her head, looking past the head of the priestess on whose arm she leaned, and into her dulled eyes, drawn with anguish, came recognition and tenderness. Igraine couldn't hear her, but it was as if Vivian spoke directly to her mind. "Little girl, little sister, Grenay." Igraine wanted to cry out to her in sorrow and grief and fear, but she could not lay her own weight of sorrows upon Vivian now. She poured all her heart into a single outcry. "I hear you, my mother, my sister, my priestess and my goddess." "Igraine, I tell you, even in this hour, do not lose hope, do not despair. There is a pattern to all our sufferings. I have seen it. Do not despair." And for a moment, her hair rising on her forearms, Igraine actually felt on her cheek a light touch, like the lightest of kisses. And Vivian whispered, "Little sister." And then Igraine saw her sister's face contorted with pain, and she fell as if swooning into the arms of the priestess, and a wind ruffled the water of the mirror, and Igraine saw her own face blurred with weeping, looking out through the water. She shivered, clutching some garment, anything to warm her, and flung the sorceress mirror into the fire. Then she threw herself down on her bed and wept. "Vivian told me not to despair. But how can I do other than despair when she is dying?" She lay there, weeping herself into a stupor. At last, when she could not cry another tear, she rose wearily and washed her face in cold water. Vivian was dying, perhaps even dead. But her last words had been to bid Igraine not lose hope. She dressed herself and hung about her throat the moonstone Vivian had given her. And then, with a little stirring of the air before her, she saw Uther. This time she knew it was ascending, and not the man himself. Nothing human. Certainly not Uther Pendragon could have come into her guarded chamber without some man seeing and stopping him. He wore a heavy plaid about him, but on his arms, and this is why she knew it no dream, he wore the serpent she had seen when she dreamed of his life in Atlantis. Only they were not now golden torques, but live serpents, which raised their heads hissing. Only she didn't fear them. "My beloved," he said. And although it was the very tone of his voice, the room was silent in the light of the flickering fire, and through the whispered voice she heard the small crackling of the juniper twigs. "I will come to you at midwinter. I swear it. I will come to you, whatever may bar the way. Make ready for me at midwinter." And then she was alone, with only the sun in the room and the reflection of the sea outside, and in the courtyard below, the laughing voices of Morgause and her little daughter. Igraine drew a long breath, calmly drank the rest of the wine. On an empty stomach, fasting, she felt it rise to her head with a sort of dizzy elation. Then she went quietly down the stairs to await the news she knew would come. Chapter 7. What happened first was that Gaulois came home. Still flustered with the elation of that moment of vision, and frightened, for she had never really thought that Vivian could die, and in spite of the words of hope, she couldn't imagine now that Vivian could live. Igraine had expected something else, some magical news of Uther, or word that Gaulois was dead and that she was free. Gaulois himself, dust-covered and hungry and scowling, was half calculated to make Igraine think her vision no more than self-deception or a delusion of the evil one. "Well, if it is so, there is good in that too, for it would mean that my sister lives, and my vision of her was a delusion born of my own fears." And so she welcomed Gaulois calmly, with food and a bath and clean dry clothes, and only pleasant words. Let him think, if he would, that she was repenting her harshness and trying to curry his favour again. It no longer mattered to her what Gaulois thought or what he did. She no longer hated him or resented the early years of misery and despair. Her sufferings had made her ready for what would come after. She served Gaulois his food and drink, saw to the housing of his men as was suitable, and forbore to question him. She brought Morgaine for a moment, washed and combed and pretty, for her curtsy to her father, and then had Isotta take her away to bed. Gaulois sighed, pushing away his plate. "She grows good-looking, but she's like a fairy child, one of the folk of the Hollow Hills. Where came she by such blood? There is none of it among my people."
"But my mother was of the old blood," Igraine said, "and Vivian too. I think her father must have been one of the fairy folk."
Gaulois shivered and said, "And you don't even know who fathered her. One thing that the Romans did well was to make an end of those folk. I fear no armed man that I can slay. But I fear those underground folk of the Hollow Hills, with their enchanted circles, and their food that can lead you to wander 100 years in enchantment, and their elf bolts, which come out of the dark and strike a man down unshriven to send him to the hells.
The devil made them for the death of Christians,
and it is the work of God to kill them, I think."
Igraine thought of the herbs and simples which the women of the fairy folk brought even to their conquerors for healing, of the poison arrows that could bring down game which could be taken no other way, of her own mother, born of the fairy people, and of Vivian's unknown father.
"And Gaulois, like the Romans, would make an end of these simple people in the name of his God."
"Well," she said, "that must be as God wills, I suppose."
"Morgaine, perhaps, should be brought up in a convent of holy women, so that the great evil she has inherited from your old blood will never taint her," Gaulois mused. "When she is old enough, we will see to it. A holy man told me once that women bear the blood of their mothers, and so it has been since the days of Eve, that what is within women, who are filled with sin, cannot be overcome by a woman-child, but that a son will bear his father's blood, even as Christ was made in the image of God his Father. So if we have a son, Igraine, we needn't fear that he will show the blood of the old evil folk of the hills."
A surge of anger rippled through Igraine, but she had pledged herself not to anger him. "That, too, must be as your God wills."
For she knew, if he had forgotten, that he would never touch her again as a man touches a woman.
It didn't matter now what he said or did. "Tell me, what has brought you home so unexpectedly, my husband?"
"Uther, of course," Gaulois said. "There has been a great king-making on Dragon Island, which is near to Glastonbury of the priests.
I know not why the priests allow it to stand there, for it is a heathen place,
and there they have paid homage to their horned one of the woods, and raised serpents, and such foolishness as it is not fitting should be done in a Christian land. King Leodegrance, who is king of the summer country, stands with me, and has refused to make compact with Uther. Leodegrance likes Uther no more than I. But he will not make war on the Pendragon now. It is not fitting that we should war among ourselves with the Saxons gathering on the eastern shores. If the Scots come this summer, we will be caught between hammer and anvil. And now Uther has sent an ultimatum, that I must put my Cornishmen under his command, or he will come and force me to. And so I am here. We can hold Tintagel for ever if we must. But I have warned Uther that if he sets foot in Cornwall, I will fight him. Leodegrance has made truce with Uther, until the Saxons are gone from this country. But I would not.
In God's name, that is folly, Igraine said, for Leodegrance is right. The Saxons could not stand if all men of Britain stood together. If you quarrel among yourselves, the Saxons can attack you one kingdom at a time. And before long all Britain will serve the horse gods.
Gaulois pushed his dishes aside. I don't expect a woman to know anything of honour, Igraine. Come to bed.
She had thought it wouldn't matter now what he did to her, that she was past caring. But she hadn't been prepared for the despairing struggle of Gaulois's pride. At the last he had beaten her again, cursing.
You have put an enchantment on my manhood, you damned witch.
When he had fallen into exhausted sleep, Igraine, her bruised face throbbing, lay awake, weeping quietly at his side. So this was the reward of her meekness, just as it had been the reward of her hard words. Now indeed she was justified in hating him. And in a way she was relieved to feel no guilt for her loathing. Suddenly, and with violence, she hoped Uther would kill him. He rode away the next morning at daylight, taking all but a scant half-dozen men who were left to defend Tintagel. From the talk she heard in the hall before they went, she knew he was hoping to ambush Uther's invading army as it came down from the moors into the valley. And all this for what he called honour. He would deprive all Britain of her high king, leave the land naked like a woman to be ravished by the Saxon hordes, all because he was not man enough for his wife, and feared that Uther would be. When he had gone, the days dragged along, rainy and silent. Then the first frosts came, with snow sweeping across the moors, and even the moors themselves were out of sight, except on the clearest of days. She longed for news. She felt like a badger trapped in a winter burrow. Midwinter. Uther had said he would come to her at midwinter. But now she began to wonder if it had been only a dream. As the autumn days lagged by, dark and cold, she began to doubt the vision. Yet she knew that any attempt to repeat it, to bring herself reassurance, wouldn't help. She had been taught in her childhood that such dependence on magical art was wrong. It was allowed to search for a glimpse of light in the darkness, and that she had done. But magic must not become a child's leading strings for walking, lest she become unable to take a single step without the need for supernatural guidance. I've never been able to rely on myself, she thought bitterly. When she had been a child, she had looked for guidance to Vivian. But no sooner than she was grown to womanhood, she had been married to Gaulois, and he felt that she should look to him in all things, or, in his absence, turn to Father Columba for constant counsel. So now, knowing she had the chance to begin to do her own thinking, she turned inward upon herself. She schooled her daughter in spinning and began to teach her sister Morgause how to weave in colours, hoarded her supply of food, for it began to look as if the winter might be colder and longer than usual, and listened ravenously to such small scraps of news as came to her from the shepherds when they went to market, or from any travellers. But there were few of these as the winter closed down over Tintagel. It was past Samhain when a peddler woman came to the castle, wrapped in rags and torn shawls, weary and footsore. Her feet were bound in rags, and she herself was none too clean, but Igraine brought her in and gave her a place by the fire, and a ladle of rich goat's meat stew with the stale bread which would have been her ordinary portion. When she saw that the woman was limping from a stone bruise, she asked the cook to heat some water, and found a cleaner rag to bind it. She bought two needles from the woman's pack. They were coarse enough, she had better ones, but they would do to teach Morgaine her first stitches. Then, feeling she had earned it, she asked the woman if there was any news from the north.
"Soldiers, lady," said the old woman, sighing, "and Saxons gathering on the northern roads, too, and a battle. And Uther, with his dragon banner, Saxons to the north of him, and, they say, the Duke of Cornwall against him to the south. Battle everywhere, even to the Holy Isle."
Igraine demanded, "You have come from the Holy Isle?"
"Yes, lady. I was benighted by the lakes there and lost in the mist. The priests gave me dry bread and bade me come to mass and be shriven. But what sins as an old woman like me? My sins are all done and over, all forgotten and forgiven, and not even regretted any more," she said, with her thin laughter.
It seemed to Igraine that she hadn't much wit, and what little she had had been scattered by hardship and solitude and long wandering.
"And indeed, there's little opportunity for the old and poor to sin, except to doubt God's goodness. And if God can't understand why we doubt that, then he's not as wise as his priests think. But I had no taste to listen to Mass, and it was colder inside their church than without. So I wandered in the mist and the fog, and then I saw a boat, and somehow I came to the Holy Isle, and there the woman of the lady gave me food and fire, like you."
"You saw the lady?" Igraine demanded, leaning forward and looking into the woman's face. "Oh, give me news of her. She is my sister."
"Aye, she said as much to me, that her sister was wife to the Duke of Cornwall, if the Duke of Cornwall still lived, which she didn't know about." "Oh, aye, she gave me a message for you. That is why I came here through moors and rocks, where my poor feet were mangled by all the stones." "Now, what did she say to me?" "Poor me, I can't remember. I think I lost the message in the mists around the Holy Isle. The priests, you know, they told me there was no Holy Isle. Not never no more, they said. God had sunk it in the sea. And if I thought I'd been entertained there, it was only witchcraft and the delusions of the devil."
She paused, bent and cackling. Igraine waited. Finally she asked, "Tell me of the Lady of Avalon. Did you see her?"
"Oh, aye, I saw her. Not like you, she is, but like a fairy woman, little and dark."
The woman's eyes brightened and then cleared.
"Now I mind the message. She said, 'Tell my sister Igraine that she should remember her dreams and not lose hope.' And I laughed at that. What good are dreams, except perhaps to you ladies in your great houses? Not much good to those of us who wander the roads in the fog. Oh, yes, this too. She was delivered of a fine son at harvest time, and she bade me say that she was well beyond all hopes and expectations, and that she had named the boy Galahad."
Igraine let out a long sigh of relief. So Vivian had indeed, against all hope, survived childbed. The peddler woman went on.
"She also said that he was a king's son, and that it was fitting that one king's son should serve another. Does this mean anything to you, my lady? It sounds like more dreams and moon shadows.
And she collapsed into giggling, hunched in her rags, spreading her thin hands to the warmth of the fire. But Igraine knew the meaning of the message. One king's son should serve another. So Vivien had indeed borne a son to King Ban of Less Britain, after the rite of the great marriage. And if, in the prophecy, she and the Merlin had made, Igraine should bear a son to Uther, High King of Britain, one should serve the other. For a moment she felt herself trembling on the edge of the same hysterical laughter as the demented old woman's. "The bride is not yet brought to bed, and here we make arrangement for the fostering of the sons." In her heightened state, Igraine saw these children, the born and the unborn, crowding round her like shadows. Was Vivian's son Galahad to be the dark twin, the bane of her unborn son by Uther? It seemed to Igraine that she could see them in the flickering of the fire. A dark, slender lad with Vivian's eyes, a stripling with shining hair like a Northman's. And then, flashing in the firelight, she saw the holy regalia of the Druids, kept now at Avalon since the Romans burned the sacred grove, dish and cup and sword and spear, gleaming and flashing to the four elements. Dish of earth, cup of water, sword of fire, and the spear or wand of air. She thought drowsily, stirring as the fire flashed and flickered, that there was a piece of the regalia for each of them. How fortunate! Fiercely she blinked, drawing herself upright. The fire had died to coals. The old peddler woman slept, her feet tucked under the shawls and rags, as close as she could roll herself to the fire. The hall was all but empty. Her waiting woman drowsed on a bench, wrapped tightly in shawl and cloak. The other serving folk had gone to bed. Had she slept here half the night by the fire and dreamed it all? She roused the sleeping waiting woman, who grumbled off to her own bed. Leaving the old peddler woman to sleep by the fire, Igraine crept shivering to her own room, crawling in beside Morgaine, and clutching the child tight as if to ward off fantasies and fear. Winter set in then, in earnest. There wasn't much wood for fuel at Tintagel, only a kind of rock which would burn, but it smoked evilly and blackened doors and ceilings. Sometimes they had to burn dried seaweed, which made the whole castle stink of dead fish, like the sea at low tide. And at last, rumour began to speak of Uther's armies drawing near to Tintagel, ready to cross the great moors. Under ordinary conditions, Uther's army could beat Gaulois' men into submission. But if they are ambushed, Uther doesn't know the country. He would feel himself threatened enough by the rocky and unfamiliar terrain, knowing Gaulois' armies would be massed near Tintagel. Uther wouldn't be expecting a nearer ambush. She could do nothing but wait. It was a woman's fate to sit at home, in castle or cot. It had been so since the Romans came. Before that, the Celtic tribes had followed the counsel of their women, and far to the north there had been an island of woman warriors who made weapons and tutored the war chiefs in the use of arms. Igraine lay awake night after night, thinking of her husband and of her lover. If, she thought, you can call a man your lover when you have never exchanged a single kiss. Uther had sworn he would come to her at midwinter. But how could he cross the moors and break through the trap of Gaulois, lying in wait for him? If only she were a trained sorceress or a priestess like Vivien. She had been reared on tales of the evil involved in using sorcery to enforce one's own will on the gods. Was it, then, a good thing to allow Uther to be waylaid and his men murdered? She told herself Uther would have spies and scouts, and needed no woman's help. Still, she felt, disconsolate, that there must be something better for her to do than to sit and wait. A few days before midwinter night, a storm blew up and raged for 2 days so fiercely that Igraine knew that northward on the moors, nothing which wasn't burrowed like a rabbit in its hole could possibly live. Even safely within the castle, people crouched near the few fires and listened, trembling, to the raging of the wind. During the day, it was so dark with snow and sleet that Igraine couldn't even see to spin. The supply of rushlights was so limited that she didn't dare exhaust it further, for there was still a long weight of winter to bear. So most of the time they sat in the dark, and Igraine tried to remember old stories from Avalon to keep Morgaine amused and quiet, and Morgause from fretting with boredom and weariness. But when at last the child and the young girl had fallen asleep, Igraine sat wrapped in her cloak before the remnants of the small fire, too tense to lie down, knowing that if she did, she would lie wakeful, staring with aching eyes into the darkness, trying to send her thoughts over the leagues that lay between... Where? To Gaulois, to find where his treachery had led. For it was treachery. He had sworn alliance with Uther as his high king, and then, because of his own jealousy and mistrust, broken his word. Or to Uther, trying to make camp on these unfamiliar moors, battered by the storm, lost, blinded. How could she reach Uther? She gathered to herself all the memories of what small training she had had in magic when she was a girl in Avalon. Body and soul, she had been taught, were not firmly bonded. In sleep, the soul left the body and went to the country of dreams, where all was illusion and folly. And sometimes, in the druid trained, to the country of truth, where Merlin's leading had taken her in dream that one time. Once, when Morgaine was being born, and the pains seemed to have gone on for ever, she had briefly left her body and seen herself lying down below, a racked thing, fussed over by the midwives and encouraged by her women, while she floated, free of pain and elated, somewhere above. Then someone had bent over her urgently, telling her that now she must work harder, for they could see the crown of the baby's head, and she had come back to renewed pain and fierce effort, and she had forgotten. But if she could do it then, she could do it now. Shivering in her cloak, Igraine stared at the fire and willed herself abruptly to be elsewhere. She had done it. She seemed to stand before herself, her whole awareness sharply focused. The main change was that she could no longer hear the wild wailing of the storm outside the walls of the castle. She didn't look back. She had been told that when you left your body, you must never look back, for the body will draw back the soul. But somehow she could see without eyes, all round her, and knew that her body was still sitting motionless before the dying fire. Now that she had done it, she felt frightened, thinking, I should mend the fire first. But she knew if she went back into her body, she would never have the courage to try this again. She thought of Morgaine, the living bond between herself and Gaulois, even though he now rejected it, spoke scathingly of the child. Still, the bond was there, and she could find Gaulois if she sought him. Even as the thought formed in her mind, she was... elsewhere. Where was she? There was the flare of a small lamp, and by its fitful light she saw her husband surrounded by a cluster of heads, men huddled together in one of the small stone huts on the moors. Gaulois was saying, I have fought beside Uther for many years under Ambrosius, and if I know him at all, he will count on courage and surprise. His people don't know our Cornish weather, and it won't occur to them that if the sun sets in raging storm, It will clear soon after midnight, so they won't move till the sun rises. But he will be out and about the moment the sun is above the horizon, hoping to fall on us while it is still early. But if we can surround his camp in those hours between the clearing of the sky and the sunrise, then, as they break camp, we can surprise them. They will be prepared for a march, not a battle. With just a little luck, we can take them before they have their weapons well out of the sheath. Once Uther's army is cut to pieces, if he himself isn't killed, he will at least turn tail and get out of Cornwall, never to return. By the dim lamp, Igraine saw Gorlois bare his teeth like an animal.
And if he is killed, his armies will scatter like a beehive when someone kills their queen.
Igraine felt herself shrink back. Even bodiless, a wraith, it seemed that Gorlois must see her hovering there. And indeed, he raised his head and frowned, brushing at his cheek.
"I felt a draught. It's cold in here," he muttered. "And how could it be otherwise? It's cold here as the pit, with the snow raging like this,"
one of his men growled. But even before he got the words out, Igraine was away from there, hovering in bodiless limbo, shivering, resisting the strong pull to return to Tintagel. She longed for the feel of flesh, of fire, not to go wandering between worlds like some flittering wraith of the dead. How could she come to Uther to warn him? There was no bond between them. She had never exchanged with him so much as a kiss of passion, which would bind their bodies of flesh, and so bind the bodiless spirit she was now. Gorlois had accused her of adultery. Frantic, Igraine wished again that it were so. She was blind in the dark, bodiless, nowhere. She knew that the flicker of a thought would take her back to the room at Tintagel, where her body, cramped and icy cold, slumped before the dead fire. She fought to remain in this deathly, blind darkness, struggling, praying wordlessly, "Let me come to Uther," while knowing that the curious laws of the world she was in now made it impossible. In this body, she had no bond with Uther. "But my bond with Uther is stronger than the bond of flesh, because it has endured for more lives than one." Igraine felt herself arguing with something impalpable, as if appealing to a higher judge than whatever it was that made the laws for this life. The darkness seemed to press on her now, and she felt that she couldn't breathe. That somewhere below her, the body she had abandoned was chilled, iced over, breath failing. Something in her cried out, "Return, return! Uther is a grown man. He doesn't need you to care for him." And she answered herself, struggling, fighting to stay out where she was. "He is only a man. He is not proof against treachery." Now, in the pressing darkness, there was a deeper darkness, and Igraine knew she looked not on her own invisible self, but on some other. Chilling, trembling, racked, she didn't hear with her bodily ears, but felt in every nerve of her whole being the command. "Go back. You must go back. You have no right to be here. The laws are made and fixed. You cannot remain here without penalty." She heard herself say to the strange darkness, "If I must, I will pay the penalty that is exacted."
"Why do you seek to go where it is forbidden to go?"
"I must warn him," she said frantically. And then, suddenly, like a moth spreading its wings over the cocoon, something in Igraine that was greater than herself opened and spread its wings, and the darkness around her was gone, and the fearsome shape warning her was no more than a veiled shape, a woman like herself, a priestess, certainly not a goddess, nor the old death crone. Igraine said steadily, "We are bound and sworn.
life to life and beyond. You have no right to forbid. Suddenly, Igraine saw that about her arms were twining the golden serpents which she had worn in her strange dream of the ringstones. She raised her arms and cried out a word in a strange language. She could never, afterward, remember more than half a syllable, only that it began with a great "Ah," and that it was a word of power. Nor did she know how the word had come to her in this extremity, to her, who wasn't even a priestess in this life. The forbidding shape before her was gone, and Igraine saw light, light like the rising sun. No, it was the dimmest of lantern lights, a rushlight shielded crudely with a thin slice of horn in a wooden box, no more than a glimmer in the icy shadows of a small stone-walled hut, tumbled down and roughly repaired with bundles of reeds. But by some curious non-existent light. Or did she, bodiless, see in the dark without eyes? She could make out a few faces in the shadows, faces she had seen round Uther in Londinium, kings and chiefs and soldiers. Exhausted and icy cold, they crouched around the tiny lantern as if its flickering fire could somehow warm them. And Uther was among them, gaunt and exhausted, his hands bleeding with chilblains, his woollen plaid drawn up closely over his head and around his chin. This wasn't the proud and kingly priest-lover she had seen in her first vision, not even the clumsy and boorish young man who had come into church disturbing them all, but this weary, haggard man, damp hair straggling around his nose, reddened with the cold, somehow seemed to her more real, more handsome than ever before. Igraine, aching with pity, longing to take him in her arms and warm him, felt as if she had cried out, "Uther!" She knew he heard, for she saw him raise his head and look all about the cold shelter, shivering as if some colder wind stirred there. And then she saw, through the cloaks and plaids huddled around his body, the serpents twining about his arms. They weren't real. They writhed like living snakes, where no snake ever known to humanity would leave its burrow in such weather. But she saw them. And somehow Uther saw her and opened his mouth to speak. Imperatively, she gestured him to silence. "You must arouse and make ready to march, or you are doomed." The message didn't form itself in her mind as words, but she knew that it moved directly from her thoughts to his. "The snow will cease soon after midnight. Gaulois and his soldiers think you are pinned down where you are now, and they will fall upon you and cut you to pieces. You must be ready to meet their attack." The words pressed upon him, soundless, with her last remnant of strength. And even as they formed, she knew that the strength of will which had brought her here across the gulf, against the laws of this world, was fading. She wasn't accustomed to this work, and she struggled, not wanting to leave with her warning unspoken. Would they believe him? Would they be ready to meet Gaulois? Or would they stay there, motionless in the darkness after the storm, and Gaulois find them like hens huddled on their roost for the fox? But she could do no more. A deathly cold, the faintness of utter exhaustion, came over her. She felt herself fading into icy cold and darkness, as if the storm were raging through her entire body. She was lying on the stone floor before the cold ashes of the fire. Over her an icy wind was blowing, as if the storm which had followed her all through her vision was raging here too, inside her body. No, it wasn't that. The wooden shutters of the room had blown open in the dying frenzy of the storm. They were slamming back and forth, and slashes of icy rain were blowing into the room. She was cold. She was so cold she felt she would never move again, that she would lie there and freeze,
and that the cold of her body would gradually change to the sleep of death. At the moment, she didn't care. There must be punishment for breaking a taboo. That is the law. I have done the forbidden thing, and I cannot emerge scatheless from it. If Uther is safe, I accept it, even if my punishment be death. And indeed, Igraine, huddling and trying to cover herself with the inadequate warmth of her cloak, felt that death would be merciful. At least she wouldn't feel the cold. But Morgaine, who slept in the bed near to that window. If the window were not closed, she would take a chill and perhaps have the lung fever. Igraine would not, for her own sake, have moved. But for her child and her innocent sister, she forced herself painfully to stir, to make her numbed hands and feet move. Clumsy, moving as if drunken, she stumbled to the window and fumbled with her frozen hands to draw it closed. The wind twice tore it from her fingers, and she heard herself sobbing as she wrestled with it. She couldn't feel, but she knew she had torn away a fingernail in the struggle with the shutter, which fought her like a living thing. At last, capturing the clasp between her hands, she drew it shut by main force, pinching a finger, cold and blue in the frame, as she managed to fasten the wooden hasp. It was still cold in the room, cold as ice, and she knew that without the fire, Morgaine and Morgause too would be ill. She wanted nothing more than to creep into bed between them, still wrapped in her cloak, warm herself between their young, warm bodies. But it was hours till morning, and she had been the one who left the fire untended. Shivering, pulling her cloak close, she took a firepan from the hearth and stole down the stairs, feeling her icy feet bruised as they stumbled on the stone. In the kitchen, three serving women curled close like dogs in front of the banked fire. It was warm there, and a steaming pot hung on a long hook over its fire. Gruel for the morning meal, no doubt. Well, it was her own kitchen, and her own gruel. Igraine dipped a cup into the pot and drank the hot, unsalted oatmeal broth. But even that couldn't warm her. Then she filled the firepan with red-hot coals and covered the firepan, and holding it in a fold of her skirt, went up the stairs again. She was weak and shaking, and despite the hot drink, shuddering so hard she feared she would fall. I must not fall, for if I fall I will never get up again, and the firepan will set something afire. She knelt before the cold hearth in her room, feeling the great shudders take her body and rack her with pain in her chest. But she wasn't cold now. She felt hot throughout her body. She fed the coals patiently with bits of tinder from the bin, then with small sticks. At last the log caught and roared up toward the ceiling. Igraine was so hot now that she flung off her cloak, stumbling toward the bed, lifted Morgaine, and lay down with the child in her arms. But she didn't know whether she slept or died. No, she wasn't dead. Death would not bring this racking, shuddering heat and cold. She knew that she lay a long time wrapped in steaming cloths which grew cold and were taken away and renewed. She knew that they forced hot drinks down her throat, sometimes nauseous herbal mixtures against fever, and sometimes strong spirits mixed with hot water. Days, weeks, years, centuries passed over her while she lay and burned and shivered and suffered the horrid stuff they poured down her throat when she was too weak even to vomit it up. Once Morgause came and asked her fretfully, "If you were ill, Igraine, why didn't you wake me and send me to mend the fire?" The dark shape who had forbidden her the road was standing in one corner of the room, and now Igraine could see her face. It was the Death Crone who guards the doors of the Forbidden, and now would punish her. Morgaine came and looked down at her, her small, sombre face frightened. And Igraine wanted to reassure her daughter, but she was too weak to speak aloud. And Uther was there too, but she knew that no one else could see him. And it wasn't seemly to call out any man's name save that of her own wedded husband. No one would think worse of her if she should call out Gorlois's name. But even if she was dying, she didn't want to call out the name of Gorlois. She wanted no more of him, in life or in death. Had she betrayed Gorlois with her forbidden sorcery? Or had that been only a dream, no more real than her attempt to warn Uther? Had she saved him? It seemed that she was wandering in the icy spaces again, trying blindly to force herself through the storm to give her warning. And once Father Columba came and mumbled Latin at her, and she was frantic. By what right did he come to worry her with the last rites when she couldn't defend herself? She had meddled in sorcery. By his standards, she was an evil woman, and he would condemn her for betraying Gorlois. He would come to avenge his master. The storm was back again, raging through her. She was wandering endlessly in the storm, trying to find Morgaine, who was lost in it. Only Morgaine was there, wearing a crown, the crown of the High Kings of all Britain. Then Morgaine was standing at the prow of the barge which passed over the summer sea to the shores of Avalon. Morgaine, wearing the robes of a priestess, the robes Vivian wore. And then all was darkness and silence. And then there was sunlight in the room, and Igraine stirred, only to discover that she couldn't sit up.
"Lie still, my lady," said Isotta. "In a little while I'll bring you your medicine."
Igraine said, and was surprised to find herself whispering,
"If I have lived through your herb drinks, I will probably live through this too. What day is this?" "Only 10 days till midwinter night, my lady. And as for what happened, well, all we know is that the fire in your room must have gone out during the night, and your window blown open. The Lady Morgaine said she woke to see you closing it, and that you went out afterward and came back with a fire pan. But you didn't speak and mended the fire, so she didn't know you were ill till morning, when you were burning with fever, and didn't know her or the child."
That was a simple explanation. Only Igraine knew that her illness was more, was punishment for attempting sorcery far beyond her strength, so that body and spirit were drained almost past returning.
"What of—"
Igraine stopped herself. She could not inquire of Uther. What was she thinking of?
"Is there news of my Lord Duke?"
"None, my lady.
We know there was a battle, but no news will come until the roads are cleared after the great storm," the serving woman said.
"But now you mustn't talk any more, lady. You must have some hot gruel and lie down to sleep."
Patiently, Igraine drank the hot broth they brought her and slept. News would come when the time was ripe.
Chapter 8. On Midwinter Eve, the weather broke again and turned fine. All day snow was melting and dripping, the roads ran mud, and fog came in and lay softly over the sea and courtyard, so that voices and whispers seemed to echo endlessly when anyone spoke. For a little while in the early afternoon, the sun came out, and Igraine went into the courtyard for the first time since her illness. She felt quite recovered now, but she fretted, as they all did, for news. Uther had sworn he would come at midwinter night. How would he manage it with Gorlois's army lying between?
All day she was silent and abstracted. She even spoke sharply to Morgaine, running about like a wild thing with the joy of being free after the confinement and cold of the winter weather. I should not be harsh with my child because my mind is with my lover, Igraine thought, and angry with herself, called Morgaine to her and kissed her. A chill went through her as she laid her lips to the soft cheek. By her forbidden sorcery, warning her lover of Gauloise's ambush, she might have condemned the father of her child to death. But no. Gaulois had betrayed his high king. Whatever she, Igraine, had done or left undone, Gaulois was marked for death, and by his treason he had deserved it. Unless, indeed, he should compound his betrayal by killing that man whom his sworn king Ambrosius had marked for the defence of all Britain. Father Columba came to her, insisting that she forbid her woman and serving men to light midwinter fires.
"And you yourself should set them a good example by coming tonight to Mass," he insisted. "It has been long, my lady, since you received the sacraments."
"I have been ill," she said indifferently. "And as for the sacraments, I seem to remember that you gave me the last rites when I lay sick. Although I may have dreamed it, I dreamed many things."
"Many of them," said the priest. "Such things as no Christian woman should dream. It was for my Lord's sake, lady, that I gave you the sacraments when you had had no opportunity to confess yourself and receive them worthily."
"Aye, I know well it wasn't for my own sake," said Igraine with a faint curl of her lip.
"I do not presume to set limits on God's mercy," the priest said.
And Igraine knew the unspoken part of his thought. He would err, if needed, on the side of mercy, because Gaulois, for some reason, cared about this woman, and leave it to God to be harsh with her, as no doubt God would be. But at last she said that she would come to Mass. Little as she liked this new religion, Ambrosius had been a Christian. Christianity was the religion of the civilized people of Britain, and would inevitably become more so. Uther would bow to the public observance, whatever his private views on religion. She didn't really know. She had had no opportunity to know how he really felt about matters of conscience. Would she ever know? "He swore he would come to me at midwinter." But Igraine lowered her eyes and tried to pay strict attention to the Mass. Dusk had fallen, and Igraine was speaking in the kitchen house to her women, when she heard a commotion at the end of the causeway, and the sound of riders, then a cry in the courtyard. She flung her hood over her shoulders and ran out, Morgaine behind her. At the gateway were men in Roman cloaks, such as Gaulois wore, but the guards were barring their way with the long spears they carried.
"My lord Gaulois left orders. No one but the Duke himself to go inside in his absence."
One of the men at the centre of the group of newcomers drew himself up, immensely tall.
"I am the Merlin of Britain," he said, his resounding voice ringing through the dusk and fog. "Stand back, man. Will you deny passage to me?"
The guardsman drew back in instinctive deference, but Father Columba stepped forward with an imperative gesture of refusal.
"I will deny you. My lord the Duke of Cornwall has said particularly that you, old sorcerer, are to have no entrance here at any time."
The soldiers gaped, and Igraine, despite her anger, stupid, meddlesome priest, had to admire his courage. It wasn't an easy thing to defy the Merlin of all Britain. Father Columba held up the big wooden cross at his belt.
"In the name of the Christ, I bid you begone. In God's name, return to the realms of darkness whence you came."
The Merlin's ringing laugh raised echoes from the looming walls.
"Good brother in Christ,"
he said. Your God and my God are one and the same. Do you really think I will vanish away at your exorcism? Or do you think I am some foul fiend from the darkness? No, not unless you call the falling of God's night the coming of darkness. I come from a land no darker than the summer country, and look, these men with me bear the ring of his lordship, the Duke of Cornwall himself. Look.
The torchlight flashed as one of the cloaked men thrust out a bare hand. On the first finger glinted Gauloise's ring.
Now let us in, father, for we are not fiends, but mortal men who are cold and weary, and we have ridden for a long way. Or must we cross ourselves and repeat a prayer to prove that to you?
Igraine came forward, wetting her lips with nervousness. What was happening here? How did they come to bear Gauloise's ring, unless they were his messengers? Certainly one of them would have appealed to her. She saw no one she recognized, nor would Gauloise have chosen the Merlin for his messenger. Was Gauloise dead, then? And was it news of his death being brought to her in this fashion? She said abruptly, her voice sounding harsh, "Let me see the ring. Is this truly his token, or a forgery?"
"It is truly his ring, Lady Igraine," said a voice she knew.
And Igraine, bending her eyes to see the ring in the torchlight, saw familiar hands, big, broad, and calloused, and above them what she had seen only in vision. Around Uther's hairy arms, tattooed there in blue woad, writhed two serpents, one on either wrist. She thought that her knees would give way, and that she would sink down on the stones of the courtyard. He had sworn it.
"I will come to you at midwinter."
And he had come, wearing Gauloise's ring.
"My Lord Duke,"
said Father Columba impulsively, stepping forward. But the Merlin raised a hand to forbid the words.
"Hush! The messenger is secret," he said. "Speak no word."
And the priest fell back, thinking the cloaked man was Gauloise, puzzled, but obedient. Igraine dropped a curtsy, still struggling against disbelief and dismay. She said, "My lord, come in."
And Uther, still concealing his face beneath the cloak, reached out with the ringed hand and gripped her fingers.
Her own felt like ice beneath them, but his hand was warm and firm and steadied her as they stepped into the hall. She took refuge in banalities. "Shall I fetch some wine, my lord, or send for food?" He murmured close to her ear,
"In God's name, Igraine, find some way we can be alone. The priest has sharp eyes even in the dark, and I want it thought it is Gauloise indeed who has come here."
She said to Isotta, "Bring food and some beer to the soldiers here in the hall, and to the Lord Merlin. Bring them water for washing, and all they desire. I will speak with my lord in our chambers. Have food and wine sent there at once." The servants went scurrying in all directions to do her will. The Merlin let a man take his cloak, and set his harp carefully on one of the benches. Morgause came into the doorway, peering boldly at the soldiers. Her eyes fell on Uther's tall form, and she dropped a curtsy. "My lord Gauloise, welcome, dear brother," she said, and started toward him. Uther made a slight forbidding movement, and Igraine stepped quickly in front of him. She thought, frowning, "This is ridiculous. Even cloaked, Uther looks no more like Gauloise than do I." She said sharply, "My lord is weary, Morgause, and in no mood for the chatter of children. Take Morgaine to your chamber, and keep her. She will sleep there with you this night." Frowning, sullen, Morgause picked up Morgaine, and carried her away up the stairs. Keeping well behind them, Igraine reached for Uther's hand and held it as they climbed. What man